the end of paper 2 in section 7, which is old single column, page 42. I don't think we need any real intro. You know, we did mercy and love and goodness, and now we have truth and beauty as a very obvious follow-on to goodness. So let's just jump right in. Let's see if we can, you know, we're kind of shooting for the first section of the next paper, too. We'll see if that's a too tall an order, but it'd be fun to bring the two together. So.
All finite knowledge and creature understanding is relative. Information and intelligence, gleaned from even high sources, is only relatively complete, locally accurate, and personally true. Physical facts are fairly uniform, but truth is a living and flexible factor in the philosophy of the universe. Evolving personalities are only partially wise and relatively true in their communications. They can be certain only as far as their personal experience extends. That which apparently may be wholly true in one place may be only relatively true in another segment of creation. Divine truth, final truth, is uniform and universal. But the story of things spiritual, as it is told by numerous individuals hailing from various spheres, may sometimes vary in details owing to this relativity in the completeness of knowledge and in the repleteness of personal experience as well as in the length and extent of that experience. While the laws and decrees, the thoughts and attitudes of the first great source and center are eternally, infinitely, and universally true, at the same time, their application to and adjustment for every universe system, world, and created intelligence are in accordance with the plans and technique of the Creator Sons, as they function in their respective universes, as well as in harmony with the local plans and procedures of the Infinite Spirit and of all other associated celestial personalities.
Who is the embodiment of the local plans and procedures of the Infinite Spirit?
Local Universe Mother Spirit.
Right, Creative Mother Spirit, yeah. Okay, so notice how interesting they start this out. They're doing a lot more here than just talking about the trueness, you know, or true character, true nature of the Universal Father, you know, God the Father. You've got all this stuff about relativity. I mean, right, you know, from the very first sentence, you know, italicizing relative and everything. Because, you know, they know if they're going to talk about this, there's potential for a lot of misunderstanding. Now, fundamentally, why is that? Let's just focus in on one little part here to really illuminate what they're bringing out in those three paragraphs. You know, we have this chart sitting here all the time. And we all know that you know, you should always be looking to recognize when they're invoking the threefold actuality, you know. And it's nothing more obvious than if they say something like, you know, things, meanings, and values, you know, one of those words, or fact, truth, goodness, or even beauty, truth, goodness. You know, I mean, those are very obvious words that are invoking the threefold actuality. So, I mean, the moment they started talking about goodness in the previous section, you know, you should be thinking, okay, so they're going to be giving me a lot to further my my threefold vision of the cosmos, so that I have some hope of getting myself on the right track as they lead me through this revelation. You know, they told us right up in the foreword that was going to be one of the very fundamental things. And, you know, what was one of the very first things I figured out, you know, recognized was fundamental, you know, was the threefold pattern and made this chart. So I had something to, you know, to anchor those thoughts on. So in that, you know, in that mode of our threefold insight, think about this spot where they're bringing in that fun completeness, repleteness, contrast again. So, owing to this relativity in the completeness of knowledge. Okay, so that's on the one hand. You have, knowledge is in this block here, where you have individuality, all the things that are sort of expressing individuality. So completeness of knowledge. So in other words, how much of a grasp you have on the facts of individuality. Now, how complete is your grasp on the facts of individuality? Now, on the other hand, and in the repleteness of personal experience, remember when we brought up the complete replete, we were recognizing that you have this sort of two-step process of filling up the finite. You have completely filling it up with all possible individuality, and then filling it up again, replete, filling it up again with all the unity that the finite can hold.
Like the spaces in between individuality, right?
Because we know, that, well, it's not, you don't want to really think of it like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it, it's refilled. So it's not like it's partly filled with individuality, then you're going to fill the cracks. With the spirit. See, it's refilled. So it's super additive. There's an overlap, very literally, in the way you're visualizing it, so that there's a super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. It's filled right here, and it's filled again right here, and there's a super additive consequence of that intimate relationship right there. You're talking about unity, spirit, you're talking about more of this block. Okay, so they're saying, all right, so you have, on the one hand, this completeness of knowledge, and so your grasp on facts of individuality, and then on the other hand, you have your grasp, remember, personal, that's, like faith, grasp, your personality is a grasping mechanism for spirit substance. So that you have this, two ways of grasping. So you grasp the facts of individuality, and then because you're a person, you can grasp the facts of unity. So you have a grasp on the two endpoints. And if you do, you're going to have then the association between the two. Like the relationship between fact and goodness is truth. So, that's what they're invoking there between the lines, getting you to think about, you grasp this end and you grasp this end, and then there's a relationship that is truth. Fact on one, goodness on the other end. Okay, so now think of the relativity of it all. I mean, there's all sorts of possible variation in how completely you have grasped the facts of individuality, or how, repletely, how you have grasped the facts of unity. So, just in each of those, there's all kinds of potential variation. So, how much variation is there in the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two? It's relativity, super additively. Okay, so that's what they're trying to get you to recognize, that very fundamentally, truth is in that mode where there's going to be lots and lots of variation. You could have someone who has a very perfect grip, but it's not likely that it spans the whole of the finite. It's just going to be part of it. Okay, and that's kind of what comes in next. So you see, when you're talking about that repleteness grasp, the repleteness of personal experience, and then they throw in, the additional reminder about how the finite works. See, as well as in the length and extent of that experience. So think about some of the basic things that can vary your grasp of unity, of values, of ideals, that endpoint. Length. Okay. You know, you're trying to get a relationship to goodness here. Does goodness equal perfection in the super universe domain? No, it's perfecting. You know, to be good is not to be perfect. To be good is to be perfecting. Okay, the very fact that the definition of goodness is tied to an ing word, a moving phenomenon, okay, there's obviously the length of experience is going to be part of this relativity. Okay. And then the extent of that experience. Well, how is the finite set up? Is it a is it all just one domain? No, first of all, there's seven super universes, you know, where each of the seven master spirits has been tasked with a very specific facet of the unity of the total finite. So in a given super universe, you can only grasp that aspect of unity that master spirit is manifesting. You have no notion of those other six facets of unity. And then on top of that, it's even more so. I mean, because it isn't all just one super universe, it's broken up into local universes, like they were just pointing out at the end. And every one of those local universes is a creator son and a creator mother spirit that is downstepping, you know, into an even more specific expression. So, that's kind of that little spot in these three paragraphs is kind of the core point where you can recognize the basic logical structure that's in play and think about it. And then, you know, I'll leave it to an exercise. Now you can go back and reread those three paragraphs and think about how they're, you know, all those sentences are just getting you to reflect on, well, yeah, you know, it could be like that and like that. I mean, there's just all of this variability. And, you know, is it a high being, a low being? Are they just, you know, a local universe being? Are they, you know, are they finality that's been to all seven super universes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's all these things in play. And the only way to get the picture, the big picture, is when all of those different viewpoints come together on paradise, and the philosophers there can gather the big picture through them. Yeah. All right. So truth, you know, fundamentally, that's, you know, it's in this associative block, and so it has, you know, just it's. You know, we always kind of talk about, you know, substance, and this is kind of more of a fluid-like. I mean, just think about this, you know, variability, and variability squared, you know, or whatever you want to call that, super additive consequence, you know. It's very variable. It's much more fluid-like, see? So there's a lot of relativity. Yeah. Okay, so the first thing is they're just trying to get you to face those facts about threefold actuality in the finite. All right.
The false science of materialism would sentence man to become an outcast in the universe. Such partial knowledge is potentially evil. It is knowledge composed of both good and evil. Truth is beautiful because it is both replete and symmetrical. When man searches for truth, he pursues the divine reality.
Okay, let's just, you know, that's a nice, you know, nice little tiny paragraph. Okay, so what are they bringing in here? Okay, false science of materialism would sentence mortal man to become an outcast in the universe. Think about, you know, we had individuality and unity. You know, if all you focus on is not only, you know, individuality, but just material individuality on top of that, where is there any unity? How are you not going to have an outcast philosophy? You know, and think about how that's expressed. You know, the earth is just a random speck of dust in the midst of a, you know, random, you know, vast universe. Yeah. I mean, see, that's outcast, you know, mentality, because there's no unity recognition. Okay, and so notice they don't say a potentially false science of materialism. Okay, it's just a false science. Right, the false science of it. Because, again, how could it be true? In order to be true, you have to connect fact to goodness, thing to value, for instance, you know, for there to be meaning. if you only have one endpoint and a very circumscribed, aspect of that one endpoint of things, individuality, how are you ever going to? It'll just be a random, a chance that you somehow get it linked to goodness in any way. And of course, there's if it's actually an ism, if it's materially ism, you're purposely trying to not let the word good or value or anything like that even enter your consciousness. Because, that's screwy thinking, that we're trying to, free ourselves from. I don't believe in purpose. I don't believe in meaning. I don't believe in value. Blah, blah, blah. You just keep repeating it like a mantra. It's obviously going to be false science. It can't be true. And then, then they bring it even to more of a point. Such partial knowledge is potentially evil. Evil is giving badness form in your mind. Just because no matter how much you try to ismize matter and make, and convince yourself that that's all there is, you have circuitry in your mind that is linking to spirit. I mean, if nothing else, your sixth adjutant, zealous like it is going to be grasping for something to give a unity-like character to make the notion of matter into an ism, for instance. Yeah. You are going to be blindly grasping at a relationship to unity. And what are the odds that you're going to grab onto goodness, a proper relationship with unity rather than badness? It's not only potentially evil, like they're saying, it's pretty likely that if you've gone anywhere with this notion, you have this hodgepodge of random grasping of good and evil. The good just because, you're initially encircuited in the Holy Spirit and given a positive inertia in the cosmos. There are no iniquitous six-year-olds. You're going to just, without even thinking about it, you're still going to be holding on to some grasp of value and goodness and whatnot, and that'll get all, blended in to all this stuff that's bad. It's just, it's right. It's a mess. See? It's an ism. Okay. So that's, they're trying to get you to use what they invoked in those first three paragraphs. We're thinking about the facts of this threefold actuality and the inexorable things that if there's no way to have this middle block if you only have one endpoint. It's like I said, why is this called are these called meanings? It's because it's a mean, and you can't take the mean of one number. Okay? You've got to have at least two things to have a mean. Okay? You can't, without values or without things, there's no meaning. Yeah, that's good. Okay? So they're just, it's like, just think about this logically, how ridiculous the notion of materialism is, when the whole point of science and the scientific method is to be trying to somehow get rid of all the random rationalizations and the fact that you can believe anything, and try to somehow be a truth seeker. You've made it impossible. You can't be a truth seeker and be a materialist. That's ridiculous. Okay. So I'm going to go from science now, see, to philosophy.
Philosophers commit their gravest error when they are misled into the fallacy of abstraction. The practice of focusing the attention upon one aspect of reality and then of pronouncing such an isolated aspect to be the whole truth. The wise philosopher will always look for the creative design which is behind and preexistent to all universe phenomena. The creator thought invariably precedes creative action.
So, if philosophy is going to be true, you got to have the big picture. You got to have God, the nucleus of it, as the originator of it. And everyone's kind of chuckling. Been in this group a long time. Such an isolated aspect to be the whole truth. That's an ism. The complete lifestyle solution. You get your consciousness wrapped around some little nugget, and you go, "Oh, that's cool." And let's make that everything, And we all know that so-called philosophy, certainly, in a modern academic setting, is nothing but a long list of isms, blankism and thisism and thatism, and it's just, you're supposed to memorize all the endless isms, and study, the guy that dreamt it up, and understand his rationalization scheme for how it's the whole truth. Yeah, none of that means anything. The very fact that you would try to make anything the answer to everything is the point I was trying to make. You cannot turn off this impulse in your mind, the religious impulse. You have this impulse in your mind to make a relationship with unity, not with, a point. You want to, that maybe all you're able to do is grab a hold of a point, but then that sixth adjutant is going to try to stretch that to the four corners of consciousness, and make it unity-like, make it an ism. See, this is why, they tell you back in the, up here from where we are now, and now it's up in the religion papers, that when you're contemplating values, you want to challenge yourself to consciousize supreme values, to recognize and strive for and be loyal to supreme values. This whole bit about, wanting it to fill all space, okay? The only thing that fills all of the finite and is true is that which is supreme. It's the only way to really, have what this impulse is driving you to. You can't do it at this level, or, even the level that's, 1 nanometer below supremacy. The only way for it to be true and fill all of the finite is if it's supreme. Now you say, wait, now I kind of see why they've broken up the finite into little pieces. So that I can, my first challenge is to spread myself to the margins of this downstepped expression of supremacy called the womb of the creative mother spirit. Okay? She's downstepping the supreme. And there's an innate one turning, it's a universe, one turning to that domain. You can satisfy this initial need to spread it to the boundaries and be true within that local universe domain. And once you've achieved that, you've recognized the boundaries and you've filled in all of the details, then you graduate. And you take up the next challenge of spreading that to the margins of the super universe and filling in all the details. And then you take it to the next universe, the central universe. And that's the process. Okay, so, there's no way that you can take it to the margins of God the Supreme, and as a first step. And so that's why it's broken up into steps. Okay? All right.
Intellectual self-consciousness can discover the beauty of truth, its spiritual quality, but only the philosophic consistency of its concepts. But only by the philosophic consistency of its concepts. But more certainly and surely by the unerring response of the ever-present spirit of truth. Happiness ensues from the recognition of truth because it can be acted out. It can be lived. Disappointment and sorrow attend upon error because, not being a reality, it cannot be realized in experience. Divine truth is best known by its spiritual flavor.
Okay, so, act it out. We always stress this as you challenge yourself to try to understand, first of all, the difference between fact and truth. You can obey truth. You can't obey fact. And then you got the next notch. Now you can try to obey error. It has a flowing sort of a character like truth, but it's not real. Okay? So no matter how much you try to follow where error takes you, you'll always find disappointment, instead of the pot of gold that you're seeking. At the end of that, illusory rainbow. No matter how good your intentions, this is error. You either have figment on one end or badness on one end or both, know, it's error. You've given untruth form in your mind. That's error. And you're trying to follow that false flow. Okay. You know, and it's only going to lead to disappointment and sorrow. You know, sorrow, especially if it's badness, you know, disappointment, you know, more kind of the figment, you know, being at the end. Now, the other key thing in here is a word you should have, the unerring response. Okay. We always talk about the, you know, when we talk about the threefold actuality, we talk about the three cosmic intuitions, the reality response. Okay. But in that block, you know, this field number four here in the chart, you know, you've got the first, the second, and the third cosmic intuitions. But down here in the fourth block, there's a field number four or two. What's there? The spirit of truth. Another reality response. See that they're literally labeling so. When we talk about, you know, recognizing, you know, causality, recognizing facts, you know, with the first, and recognizing value with the third, for instance, and, you know, recognizing the difference between right and wrong with the second, you notice the word truth wasn't in, you know. And it's in, see, when you bring these three together with personality, now you don't just have sort of the mere factual, you know, truth here, you know, between the relationship between fact and goodness. And you bring in personality, you know, I mean, this whole relativity of truth that they're invoking. I mean, truth has higher and higher levels of, you know, of recognition, even within a, you know, an initial set of endpoints that you're dealing with, fact and goodness. You can recognize truth at higher and higher levels within that system. See, so you have this, you know, that spirit of truth. You know, that's what really directly allows you to recognize truth. Okay, and again, just think about, you know, if you think about the super additivity literally, you can appreciate this. If you start to really think of the threefold stuff that we're always invoking, you know, in a triangle fashion, you know, vertical triangle, where you have like fact and goodness, and then super additively you have truth. So, I mean, if you're going to recognize truth, you've got to get up out of the plane where the fact and goodness are. You know, personality is what's above this system of three. See, when you really bring in personality, now you're bringing in a level of recognition that's upon which truth is. And that's why there's that other part of the reality response there. You can't directly recognize truth down here where fact and goodness are because it's super additive. You've got to, you know, let your personality lift you above the actuality. See, this is reality here, threefold actuality, and this is reality. And that's where you really directly can see truth, recognize truth with an insight. Okay? And so you have those three spiritual gifts. You know, two spiritual gifts. One's a threefold spiritual gift, and then, you know, and then the spirit of truth. The spirit of fact and the spirit of truth. Holy Spirit and the spirit of truth. Together, you have this reality response to things. When you engage things, it will have a spiritual flavor. Okay, that's what they're talking about. That's what the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth, they will give things this reality response. What that is it has, in other words, it has a spiritual flavor. It's like, that's something more. I can't explain to you. I feel that there's something more there. How would I describe this? Like, well, it has like a spiritual flavor to it. Okay? That's what you're getting at there. That's what they're invoking.
It seems like within this, there must be something that could help to heal the minds of people who are sorrowful, maybe not clinically depressed or, you know, suffering from chemical imbalances that they can't just heal with new thoughts.
Yeah.
But with those people who could be healed with new thoughts, it seems like there's something in here that could be used.
So, yeah, and it's right there in those last two words. If you actually can taste spirit, okay, if you have engaged things and you and it has and they now have a spiritual flavor, see, it means you actually have a direct engagement of spirit. And now there's a new gravity that's in play. If you actually have grabbed a hold of it spiritually and you've tasted its spiritual flavor, you know, this is not just wishful thinking. You know, you've gotten a reality response. Spirit gravity will lift you up. I mean, that's the cure for being down in a depression. And don't underestimate the power of that. Which do you think is more powerful, God or your molecules? I mean, you could have some very serious problems with your molecules. There's a bit of a foundational depression invoking phenomenon here in play, you know, that we're trying to fix with chemistry and stuff. Okay? Maybe. But I would give God a really good shot, okay? That he can pull me up, you know, and I don't need, you know, to bring in the blacktop. Okay, if I'm not trying to drive on that road anymore with that big bump in it, big dip in it, it doesn't matter if there's a dip there. I'm riding on this road up here. And how can I ride on that road? Because the spirit gravity holds me up there. It doesn't allow material gravity to drag me down onto that bumpy road. You know? That's the big problem with psychology. You know? I mean, it leaves out the most important thing in the universe, the most powerful force in the universe to cure your mental ills, God. Okay? You know, you can try pushing it up from the bottom, and don't be surprised that, you know, it's unstable. If you flop off, I think I'm getting better. No. Okay? No, let God just lift you up stably. Don't try to push yourself up with chemicals.
I guess I'm not getting the way they're using this here, but it seems like you can experience sorrow and disappointment. And here they're saying it's an error and it's not.
No, that's all that you'll get with error. I mean, sure, you know, you're following truth. Oh. There's going to be disappointment and sorrow, but, you know, there's not going to be any positive feedback.
Right, with error. Okay.
Yeah, with error. Yeah.
That is your barometer. If you're feeling disappointment or sorrow, you've got to be in error.
If that's all you got happening, you know, the problem might not be that vast conspiracy out there. Okay, it may be you and your false initial assumptions. Try changing your initial assumptions so they are not erroneous, and then follow the truth.
The eternal quest is for unification, for divine coherence. The far-flung physical universe coheres in the Isle of Paradise. The intellectual universe coheres in the God of Mind, the conjoint actor. The spiritual universe is coherent in the personality of the eternal Son. But the isolated mortal of time and space coheres in God the Father through the direct relationship between the indwelling thought adjuster and the universal Father. Man's adjuster is a fragment of God and everlastingly seeks for divine unification. It coheres with and in the paradise deity of the first source and center.
Okay. The eternal quest is for unification. The other name for the spirit of truth is spirit of unification. Yeah. So the paragraph they invoke the spirit of truth. The next thing they say is unification. The other aspect of the spirit of truth, besides being a reality response directly for truth, it's also the spirit of unification. It's fostering you moving towards divine coherence, sticking, you know, here, together. Now, you would like to have something stick you together. Okay? You know, you're starting out as a bunch of parts. You're starting down, way down at the individuality, as far removed from unity as you can be founded and still get to unity. You know, so you're pretty much nothing but individuality, parts to start with. And not only that, that, you know, they just mentioned the but the isolated mortal of time and space. You even have the Father, you know, is the deity of the individuality of the parts. He absolutely partified you by giving you a personality. Okay, it's all about parts to start with. So you have nothing but a challenge, you know, in front of you, to find coherence, to bring, to make the parts stick together, cohere. Okay, and they're not going to stick together in the presence of the aisle. They're not going to stick together in the presence of the sun. They're not going to stick together in the presence of the conjoined actor. It's not those absolutes of matter, mind, and spirit. You know, it's this fragment of cohering catalyst, you know, a catalyst of coherence that's been stuck within your mind. You know, it reaches, you know, he reached out to where, you know, you are, where you're not in the immediate presence of those, of the, you know, the influence of those three other absolutes. He has to reach out where they can't and give you the seed of coherence so that you can begin this process. Okay, see, so, you know, and that very first thing, you know, that post-Pentecost, that unification that Spirit of Truth is doing as the Spirit of Unification is connecting you as a seventh circler to an adjuster. An adjuster can come when you're a seventh circler because it's the Spirit of Unification. It allows you, you know, your mortal self to cohere, to stick together with an adjuster. If that glue is taken away, there's no coherence because it's the Spirit of Unification. Okay? The adjuster and yourself stick together because of the Spirit of Unification. They cohere. Okay? So they just invoked all of that literal image there. All right, give us a little more here.
The discernment of supreme beauty is the discovery and integration of reality. The discernment of the divine goodness in the eternal truth. That is ultimate beauty. Even the charm of human art consists in the harmony of its unity.
Just one little thing again, because it's a nice little, again, evoking this vertical thinking, you know. Okay, so you have discernment of supreme beauty. Well, you've got it. So you've got beauty all the way up at the top here. And you think about its relationship to divine goodness, giving this super additive eternal truth. Well, if you go up, you know, and recognize that truth up there, you started at supreme. So, what can you recognize up there? Not just supreme beauty, but ultimate beauty. Mm-hmm. See? Because truth is super additive. See, just follow it up. Yeah. If I go above supreme, if I see the beauty of the truth up there, I'm above supreme. So, I'm going to be seeing ultimate beauty. Yeah. It's over and over there. They're trying to get you thinking. Yeah. Okay? In the vertical structure.
The great mistake of the Hebrew religion was its failure to associate the goodness of God with the factual truths of science and the appealing beauty of art. As civilization progressed, and since religion continued to pursue the same unwise course of overemphasizing the goodness of God to the relative exclusion of truth and neglect of beauty, there developed an increasing tendency for certain types of men to turn away from the abstract and disassociated concept of isolated goodness. The overstressed and isolated morality of modern religion, which fails to hold the devotion and loyalty of many 20th century men, would rehabilitate itself if, in addition to its moral mandates, it would give equal consideration to the truths of science, philosophy, and spiritual experience, and to the beauties of the physical creation, the charm of intellectual art, and the grandeur of genuine character achievement.
Go ahead and read that next one too.
The religious challenge of this age is to those far-seeing and forward-looking men and women of spiritual insight who will dare to construct a new and appealing philosophy of living out of the enlarged and exquisitely integrated modern concepts of cosmic truth, universe beauty, and divine goodness. Such a new and righteous vision of morality will attract all that is good in the mind of man and challenge that which is best in the human soul. Truth, beauty, and goodness are divine realities. And as man ascends the scale of spiritual living, these supreme qualities of the eternal become increasingly coordinated and unified in God, who is love.
Okay. So definitely don't let those paragraphs just be about that other person. Challenge yourself with those two paragraphs. Find where you're still stuck, most likely in not noticing that you're stuck, in this history that they just reminded you of. How much do you overemphasize the goodness of God? You're going, well, that's impossible. You can't overemphasize the goodness of God. No, they just said it. Okay? How much do you overemphasize the goodness of God, for instance? How much do you not have a threefold insight? How much is it all just this part of it, the goodness part? You know, notice the, you know, all these little details in there about that. Does it say only if they would only give consideration to the truths of spiritual experience? Is that what that says? No, it says the truths of science, philosophy, and spiritual experience. Now, how much, you know, just ask yourself, so as I've been reading the book, how much have I just been looking for the spiritual truths in it? Maybe I've been overemphasizing the goodness of God. Maybe I should look for the other truths so I can get actual truth. You know, for it to be true, it has to be threefold. Though it's easy to, you know, say, well, you know, I believe in God, you know, I haven't, you know, I'm not in this mode where, you know, I've sort of just given up on the whole notion because it all just seems to be a bunch of moralism. You know, I'm not one of those. Well, yeah, okay, you may not be one of those, but, you know, how much is the other aspects in play? You know, and I say that not because I've completed this process. I say this because that's the process I'm always in. Every single thought I have, I'm challenging it. I'm attempting to refute it with the truth of the revelation. You know, and the first things that you'd have to refute are these little blind spots where you've been dragging old baggage in from the past and don't realize it. It's like, wow, I've just been kind of going with that because, you know, that's my parents kind of set me in motion that way, and I just kept rolling in that way, and, you know, and, you know, and so it's been going for generations.
That's,
you know,
how we roll.
That's how we roll.
That's
what
it is.
And so, you know, it's, you know, the truths. I mean, like I've tried to point out, I mean, like they're just saying, I mean, the whole point of science is truth. The scientific method is not to seek fact, it's to seek truth. That's the whole point of science, because it's not about information, it's about knowledge. You know? You know, it's just so sad that, you know, this has all just gotten muddled up. And you know, so their challenge is rediscover this, people. You know this to be true. That the whole point is an overarching truth that your personality can engage, not something that's just kind of this sort of abstraction association down on the plane of fact and goodness, but something that actually is super additive, and you're engaging it there. All right.
When it says giving consideration to the charm of intellectual art and the grandeur of genuine character achievement, mm-hmm. I wonder how you... Intellectual art, my first thing that comes to mind is maybe poetry, but...
Well, I don't know. But
or just, well, you know, how much society has tried to corrupt the word art. Well, it's art if I say it is. No, it's not. art is an objective fact, not a subjective imposition upon me. Either it has a reality response or not. If it doesn't, it's not art. And that reality response is objective. We can have it in common. True art will be recognized by all true persons. Genuine persons.
So is the Urantia book intellectual art?
Yes. It's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece of construction. The beauty with which they, we talk about that all the time. It's insanely beautiful.
It seems like art is subjective. What's art to you?
That's the whole point. It so seems like it is. That's because it's sad to record. See, the very fact that I would have that first thought that it's subjective, it's like, wait a minute. That's not what the Revelation tells me about art. Read what they say about what true art is.
It's supposed to be objective.
Yeah.
It's supposed to feel art.
We are all supposed to rise up above our subjectivity and engage it. That's what art is. It's a transcendent fact. It's taking something that is down there at the subjective level, things, and you arrange them in a certain way. Paint blobs on a piece of canvas, if they're arranged in a certain way, they somehow transcend paint blobs and canvas. There's this magical thing that happens. That's art. When it simultaneously lifts everyone up away from its material thingness. That's where it's most definitive. You have fact, truth, and goodness. Just as, in the mere actuality of thinking about things, the mechanical way and level of thinking about things. But when you bring in the fullness of personality, you have field number 7 here. Now it's beauty, truth, and goodness. Truth and truth, goodness and goodness, but fact went to beauty. That's the door, the gateway to this transcendence. So if you're focusing on matter as materialism, so there's no, attempt to go from fact to beauty, because there's no unity being brought in that could possibly, transcend the mere factness of us. You're purposely driving yourself down into animal consciousness. You're purposely forcing yourself away from personality. The extent to which humans think that art is subjective is the extent to which they are just animal consciousness, not persons. Persons know what art is. Animals can't know what art is. That's the whole point.
I think we must be overusing the word art and applying it to certain things that it's really not applicable to. The thing that's coming to my mind, for example, is that I find Chinese opera music, extremely difficult to listen to. And if I ever happen to be around somewhere where it's playing, I immediately leave. I hate that. And then there are kinds of music that I absolutely love that maybe some Chinese person would hate. So I don't think we can apply the word art to them.
Yeah, or at the very least, you're going to have to get a little bit more precise about this. And again, and remember what they said at the beginning of this about how relative truth is. It's like, well, okay. There may be a measure of challenge to transcendence within a certain circumscribed, ethnic, or genetic domain. But we're trying to not just have merely art. We're trying to have true art. In the same way, we're trying to have true science, true philosophy, and true religion. So think about it just like religion. It's just like religion. You've got all these religions that are tailored to these little pockets of genetic similarity, basically, or experiential similarity. It's like, well, okay, yes, but that's not true religion. True religion is what transcends all those things. True art is the same way. See, so that's one way you could sort of begin, you know, have an easy way to begin to put precision into your discussion of it, and without coining a new word.
Well, Chris, doesn't it depend on the culture? I mean, because a totem pole may be art too.
All right, but that's what we're saying. That's all we're saying.
Okay, so it's
there's art, but then there's true art, which, you know, you probably want to say, you know, I'll bet we haven't even really recognized true art yet. Instead of saying, well, that's just art, but that's true art. Well, you know that the only way I've got to go up to get to true art, because fact is here and truth is up here. The moment that you allow the word to be in motion, now you're beginning to be a truth seeker. You know, the moment you say, well, okay, I know what art is, and I'm going to chisel it on this stone. Okay. Then you're not a truth seeker. See, the key is to allow these things to be free. Let them loose. And now seek. You know, he's like, well, you know, this is, I think, is really transcendent. Maybe this is true art. Well, not to the next generation who's going to transcend that so much that that'll look, you know, like chicken scratches. Okay. That's, you know, so again, true art, see, is something that's flowing through time. You know, it's not this is true art here and evermore. Truth is ever relative. So true art, see, what you want to do is you want to strike step with the flow of true art. It's not in the past. It's not in the present. It's always in the future. But the flow is now. Seek. You know, that, you know, the greatest expression of truth, beauty, and goodness that you can find now. Surround yourself with that. Why? Not because that's the end point. It's because you know that that could possibly lead you to the next thing. You know, there's no way that which is secondary now is going to lead you to the next step. Only that which is primary right now leads to the next thing. Seek that which is primary now. You know, and then you're in the flow of truth. You know, do all things well, for instance. You know, there's another bit about striking step with truth. Don't just do what's good enough for government work, quote unquote. You know, do it well, or don't do it at all. Because, I mean, if you're not going to do it well, you have no interest in truth. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, what's the whole point? I mean, that's the only thing that's going to be really satisfying is when you're flowing with the truth.
You can find truth in a lot of different things. You can find it in literature. You can find it in history.
Right, you're striking step with it. You're moving into it.
It's moving,
yeah. Yeah. Right. You can find truth flowing through a book. You know, that's what this is. You know, it's not in the book statically. It's flowing through the book.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times these types of discussions, it's more a discussion of semantics. Okay, well, how should this word be defined or whatever? Like we were discussing the word love, and or you could say the word religion, and I think you could look at it like you have this big. We don't have that many words in the English language, and so we use the word religion for a lot of things which aren't true religion, or we use the word love, which for a lot of things that aren't really true love from the Aranjuez point of view, but. I don't think they're advocating that we say, oh, you can't ever use the word art unless it's true. You know, it's ultimately these words are useful in this world that we live in. The word art has, if you're going to school and you're studying art, then, you know, it's a certain genre of study. And, you know, but then when they're talking about true art, it's sort of a part that's sort of hard to maybe define. But
And there's an intermediate, just one more thing, and then we'll read the rest here. There's an intermediate thing to bring in, too. You know, once you recognize there's this sort of this, you know, this... you know, the binary viewpoint, false and true. Okay, now there's a staircase, you know, that leads you from this, you know, from one to the other. You know, take art up the levels of meaning, just like you take love up the levels of meaning. I mean, that's the way to begin to strike step with truth, is if your definition of all these things is moving up. Is art something that just leads to feeling, for instance? Okay, well, that's better than it, you know, down at the level of the flesh, okay. But now, you know, if you've found art that at least invokes a feeling, now see if you can find art that takes it up another notch. And, you know, and it's like, well, what the heck would that be? Well, that's, yeah, see, that's the very first thing that you want to have in your head is a question mark. You know, if you form that question, guess what? The universe is going to start working with you to guide you to the answer to that question. But as, the moment that you say, well, this is totally satisfying to me. This is whole truth. I'm gonna create an ism about this level of art. You know? Call it expressionism or something, okay? And let's just dwell there forever. Can't we just build a tabernacle and dwell here forever? Okay? See, no. Keep moving it up. And then you're following truth. So just
around you.
If you're moving up the levels of meaning, then you're following truth. You know, obviously there's going to be more greater truth than that, but at least that's getting you started. You know, you're in motion.
And that's what we're doing. We're just getting started.
Right. Let yourself be started. Let the initiator initiate you.
All truth, material, philosophic, or spiritual, is both beautiful and good. All real beauty, material art, or spiritual symmetry, is both true and good. All genuine goodness, whether personal morality, social equity, or divine ministry, is equally true and beautiful. Health, sanity, and happiness are integrations of truth, beauty, and goodness, as they are blended in human experience. Such levels of efficient living come about through the unification of energy systems, idea systems, and spirit systems.
Okay. Yeah, that's now they're starting to really challenge you a little bit more on the civilizational level, too. Again, all truth, material, philosophic, and spiritual. Repeating that. Notice little things like all real beauty, material art, or spiritual symmetry. Beauty, you know, that's related to fact. Okay, you've got two substances. Okay? See, so that you can have beauty with material substance or beauty with spirit substance. Those, you know, one of those two facts. So you just notice how these little things in there. Look at the powerful one in the midst of goodness. Doesn't say social equality, does it? No, it doesn't. We all know that is probably the most problematic philosophical thing going on the planet. Yeah. It does not say social equality. That is not genuine goodness. That's an illusion. Okay? Genuine goodness is social equity. Yeah. Now, what's the difference? Equality is a spirit word. Equity is a cosmic word, you know, and search the words social equality in the book. You'll find it occurs one time. I bet John knows where it is.
I can't remember.
Luke.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Luke introduced the notion of social equality, that fallacy, you know, into the teachings of Jesus. Jesus didn't teach social equality. Jesus taught social equity. And there's a world of difference. It's nothing but difference. The pursuit of social equality will lead to nothing but... That's an error.
Yeah.
No, what's that? What did they say when you try to follow error? Disappointment and sorrow.
Yeah.
Okay? It's like, well, how could I have the best of intentions? Equality is a powerful spirit word. How could that? It'll only lead to disappointment and sorrow. You know what? You have a vague notion that you should be seeking something like that. Yeah, you're just a little off. The word's not equality, it's equity. And the more you challenge yourself to figure out what that difference is, and not just have me try to give you a pithy sentence, okay? That's one of the most important things you could challenge yourself to do. Every day, try to work on that. You know, and try to notice, so when you know someone's kind of talking in that area, try to discern. It's like, well, now, okay, if I step back, do they understand equity, or is that just equality illusion in their head there? And look for it. Challenge yourself. The word equity and the difference to from equality won't really start to have a reality response until you begin to have some objective relationship to that domain of reality where those two words dwell. You know, those two words have a place that they dwell in infinity. And until you get to that space in reality, it's like, oh, that's equality and that's equity. And that's just part of the picture. And this is an expression of cosmic character, of a harmonization where one element was that spirit side. I can't get the whole picture with just the spirit side. But see, again, you know, is it not obvious how this happened? I mean, Jesus comes as a spiritual uplifter. People, you know, there's a more definitive spiritual consciousness in place because he uplifted it out of the dust. And so there it is now, finally, as a definitive ongoing phenomenon in mankind, spiritual consciousness. You're going to start to really definitively use and culturize spirit words. They're going to start to drive civilization as a collective phenomenon, spirit, you know, notions. Okay. So, of course, that would be the way things have gone, that we would be overemphasizing the notion of social equality, the notion of the goodness of God. You know? The fixate on social equality is to overemphasize the goodness of God. Okay. The fifth epical revelation is here to take us to the next step. Now you have the two things in the plane. Now go up. I would lead you up. See, he gave you the other foot point in the plane. You know, he uplifted it out of nothing, you know. Okay, now you can put both feet down. Now put them together. He says, I would lead you up to recognition. You know, the doorway to objective perspective. You got to go up. You got to put the two together.
This is the cosmic uplifter.
Yeah. All right. The revelation is the cosmic uplifter. It's, you know, it's the, I mean, the definitive from paradise, you know, will be the magisterial son. But this is to get us going and to help to prevent the collapse of civilization before the magisterial son gets here. Just like Melchizedek was trying to keep spiritual, you know, civilization from collapsing before Michael got here.
Am I the only one in the room who's just totally bogged down in the meaning of social equity?
Yeah.
No. No.
Of course you're not. We're going to talk about it all the time. We're going to talk about that a lot. I just wanted to really point out that, you know, it's right here towards the beginning here that they're sticking that seed in your mind. Let's work on developing it.
Does it cause tension? Then engage?
Yeah. I mean, the important point is just to put that in front of you. It's like, wow, I don't know what the heck that is. But they just told me I should know what it is. It's part of genuine goodness. I got to figure out what the heck that is. Okay, now you're on the path towards the truth. Don't try to, like I was saying, don't try to figure it out. Just, okay, now I've got that figured out. Don't have to think about that again. No, you want to be starting an eternal journey figuring out what the heck equity is, because it's ever relative on top of this, see? See, that's why spiritual social equality is so enticing. It's easy to go absolutist with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice package.
Yeah. And that's therein lies the problem. You know, no one, it takes you out of the flow of truth and this ever relative thing. Social equity is a process, not, you know, a fixed point. Not like, not, you know, Not where you just, okay, got the equal sign, done with that. No.
Are you applying this spiritually or materially?
I'm applying this universally. Yeah, good. Look, well, start by looking up the word, start by looking up the word equity.
I think it means fairness, right?
Well, I mean, no, you're not going to look up what the you're not going to let the dictionary define it. You're going to let the revelation define it. But start with the dictionary and see what people have been, you might say, the dictionary might say, well, one of the meanings of equity is equality. Okay, and there you go, oh, well, okay, so this, in other words, humans are pretty limited on. Maybe humans don't even know the difference between equality and equity. I mean, it's another equal-like word. So what's it? It's like, what's the difference between omnipresence and ubiquity? Well, the dictionary says they're synonyms. But the revelators are not using them as synonyms. I got to figure out what the heck that difference is. Just start trying to figure it out. Okay, let's roll some more here. Yeah. I think we're going to have to forego the first section. We're not going to. We'll do the preface maybe in the next paper.
Truth is coherent. Beauty attractive, goodness stabilizing. And when these values of that which is real are coordinated in personality experience, the result is a high order of love conditioned by wisdom and qualified by loyalty. The real purpose of all universe education is to effect the better coordination of the isolated child of the worlds with the larger realities of his expanding experience. Reality is finite on the human level, infinite and eternal on the higher and divine levels. Presented by a divine counselor acting by authority of the Ancients of Days on Universal.
Okay, a couple things here before we move on. Let's just bring in one more little thing from that previous paragraph. Notice how what there's, truth is coherent, beauty attractive, goodness stabilizing. Notice up here they had a sequence of three things: health, sanity, and happiness. Okay, body, mind, and spirit, or even more precisely, personal spirit. Joy is just mere joy is a. That's just a spirit word. That's a spiritual experience, joy. I remember that's one of the, when you have the list of the fruits of the spirit, just the mere fruits of the spirit. Joy is one of those single word things. Okay, that's a spirit word. Joy is a spiritual experience. But happiness, involves choice. You have to choose to be happy. Okay, so body, mind, spirit, in a full personal sense, health, sanity, and happiness. And, all this about, unification of energy systems, ideas systems, and spirit systems. You could even say health is attractive. Sanity is coherent. By definition, if you have coherence of mind, you're sane. Happiness, that's about that stability. You've chosen to be stable. You've chosen, to weave the three together. Health, sanity, and happiness, are like science, philosophy, and religion. True science, true philosophy, and true religion. True health, true sanity, they're really a threefold system. You're achieving all three together. Yeah. So that's one of the things they're really stressing here is what they promised you they'd stress right up there in the foreword. That's so different than anything that humans have really appreciated, that it's a fundamentally a threefold actuality. It's just, you can't go around that. God will not be mocked. Okay? You have to face the fact that the only way to get what you want in any of the three areas is by bringing all three up to that level. And it's like, well, I want something really high in the spirit domain. Well, you know, that means you're going to have to bring the other two all the way up there too. Okay. Now the just one little thing about that, you know, and it might even be related to what, you know, Lincoln said about happiness. You know, they make it so that, you know, you can invoke the third cosmic intuition to a greater degree than you're invoking the first and second at the same time. You know, you're not forced to. You know, these they're decoupled. Okay. And one of the reasons for that is health may just, you know, there may be some things that you just can't do anything about. You're going to have to face that fact, that no amount of wishful thinking is going to, you know, change this particular health issue. Right, you know, there's just an inescapable issue there. You're going to need to offset that a little bit by bringing in some more spiritual strength. Okay? See, and that, because there's two substances, you know, an inadequacy in the material substance side can be offset some because there's another substance. If you are talking about actual spirit, not wishful thinking, but actual spirit, you are given your ability to bring these three things in, so that even in the midst of relatively poor health, you can find there's a happiness that can be chosen in the midst of that, and you'll find that what that does is it changes the way you look at your health. You know, it's like, no, now that I think about it, I am healthy. I don't need to be any more healthy than this. I'm fine. This is healthy enough. I can cheerfully endure this. I can go forward. You don't want to think about this. I just wanted to bring in that little example so you don't get thinking too simplistically here. Use your ability as a person to balance the three. You know, the personality is riding over the top of these three, so it rules, and it can find the proper harmonization of the three that faces the facts in play. Okay, so happiness is possible even if the full imagination of health is not.
Chris?
Yeah.
Are you saying that if someone has a particular problem in health and they think, well, if I only had enough faith, I could overcome this, isn't that really a kind of magical thing?
Yeah, that's a magic. You know, that word faith is, they're invoking magic there. Yeah. It's like, I don't want to have faith. I want to have grown that faith into trust. So it's not just spiritual faith, it's soul trust. And now my faith is built, the faith, when faith comes in, it's on the foundation of trust. Remember how they use that faith trust thing? The reason for challenging yourself to begin to mature some of your initial faith into trust, so that subsequent faith is built upon that trust foundation, is because, like I said, it's spiritual faith, but it's soul trust. Soul is your substance. It's literal. There's literal spirit fibers involved. That's what you need. You need some literal spirit substance, some literal spirit strength. No amount of wishful thinking is literal spirit fibers, literal spiritual strength to make up for the inadequacies of the matter that you're confronted with. You have to build that faith into trust. Yeah, so that it's so that there's spiritual strength. You are not yet a first stage spirit. You're not even fused. You know, so don't think that that adjuster is what you're looking for. You know, you need spiritual strength. You do not yet have access to the spiritual strength that the adjuster has. You need to choose to grow that of your own. After all, that's the extent to which you grow that. That's what can actually fuse to the adjuster. Yeah, and now here, supply the favorable. Right, exactly. You know, and we know the technicalities of that. Yeah.
Entropy's gonna
get us. Sure. Right. But you know, entropy doesn't apply to spirit substance. It only applies to material substance.
A wise provision.
Perforce, you serve two masters, but you serve two. There's two substances. You know.
Mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter.
Right. You know that's why this, you know, that's the interface. I mean, you know, if there's actual spirit strength, it can come down through the mind. You know, and you may even be surprised, you know, if you stabilize your your grip on genuine spirit reality, you may find that there's some actual, you know, let's say they talked about energy systems, and spirit systems. I mean, you know, spirit and mind and matter are literal energies. You know, you may be able to fix that matter a little bit if you get some solid grip on spirit that comes down through mind and can dominate matter. It may not be as bad as you thought if you can actually get some top-down help. Don't expect it to magic, like, you know, fix everything, but you know, you may find that spiritual strength actually gets converted into some newly formed material strength. It may put the molecules back together again a little bit. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of strong stuff in here. And then that last little bit. The real purpose of all universe education is to effect a better coordination, okay? You know, go up to the end of section 6 in paper 16. The purpose of education is to develop and sharpen your relationship to reality through the three cosmic intuitions. That's the, you know, they're saying the same thing. So you just put these, you know, put those two sentences together. It's not like there's somehow a contradiction here. There's two purposes. It's the same purpose they're talking about. You know, the purpose of all universe education is to effect a better coordination of the isolated child of the worlds with the larger realities of the expanding experience. How do you do that? There's only one way. By taking delight in cultivating a relationship with the, you know, first the three cosmic intuitions. And then the extent to which you achieve that, you can bring in some actual spirit of truth. You'll have supplied the favorable conditions for the spirit of truth to begin to add to that, and you'll have a fourfold reality response now instead of just a threefold. You know, and you'll have this real coordination, you know, with the harmony of the cosmos. And don't be surprised if some of that harmony now can manifest within you. All right, so we'll just do the preface to this, and I want to do this transition, you know, because we're in the midst of this. So notice what happens here with these, with paper 2 and paper 3. They're very parallel titles. One is the nature of God, and then 3 is the attributes of God. Okay. So what's the difference between the word nature and the word attributes? Okay. The nature of God is what you can recognize through your spiritual insight. Oh, and I should mention, you know, remember how they use that spiritual insight up there? And if you think about it, they're not just talking about just the third cosmic intuition. You know, you can call all, you know, it's all three of the Holy Spirit, coming from the Holy Spirit, all three together are a spiritual insight. You know, and so sometimes they use it in a generalized sense and sometimes in a specific sense you need to notice in context. I mean, they're using it in a general sense. Okay, so you have this threefold insight. that allows you to recognize the nature of God. Okay? So let's, you know, go back and just notice what they're challenging you in paper two to recognize about the nature of God. They want you to recognize that God is infinite. God is eternal. God is just. God is righteous. God is merciful. God is love. God is good. God is true, and God is beautiful. You can't deduce that. You have to recognize that. All of those have to be recognized with your insight. Those things that you recognize with your insight are the nature of God. Now we're going to go to the next step. Well, what can you deduce from that? Having now recognized the nature of God, how do you interpret that? Discover, recognize, interpret, okay? Okay. Attributes of God are those aspects that you get more deductively rather than through insight. I mean, if you look up the dictionary, you'll see that's what attribute, you know, that's the difference between attribute and nature. Okay?
Starts from those insights.
Right, basic right. Insights. You've got to have, you know, you can't have, there's no deductive reasoning chain without an initial assumption. Just, you know, there's a very easy one. If you compare the title of the first section in paper two to the title of the first section in paper three, the title of the first section in paper one is The Infinity of God. Or, no, yes, section one of paper two, right, is The Infinity of God. Section one of paper three is God's everywhereness. Okay, if God is infinite, therefore, God is omnipresent in the finite. I mean, if he's infinite, he deductively has to be omnipresent in the finite. Okay, see, that's an attribute of God because you deduce that from a nature of God. Okay. So that's the kind of things they're going to be developing in paper three. So let's just read the preface a little bit.
Well, I presume that all five of these first papers were written by the same divine counsel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paper three, the attributes of God. God is everywhere present. The universal Father rules the circle of eternity. But he rules in the local universes in the persons of his paradise creator sons, even as he bestows life through these sons. God has given us eternal life, and this life is in his sons. These creator sons of God are the personal expression of himself in the sectors of time and to the children of the whirling planets of the evolving universes of space.
Got a little poetry flourish there in the end. Yeah. Okay, I mean, we got to stop there. Just, okay, you know, you've figured out how this works now. You know, you see this quote, God has given us eternal life, and this life is in his sons. What did they tweak in that Bible quote?
The plural.
Plural, right. You know that if you go look that up,
there's one son.
In John's first epistle, yeah, it'll say son. Yeah, you know, and you know he's talking about, you know, Jesus, okay. This should be pretty easy now to spot all of these basic tweakings that they're doing. Even if you've never read the Bible, you know the Bible doesn't say plural sons. Okay. And if you look it up, it's word for word, except for that, changing that plural. Okay. Or changing that singular into the plural.
I don't think it also says, to the children of the whirling planet.
Well, the quote ends at sons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that a wonderful, yeah, the whirling planets of the evolving universes of space, yeah.
But there is a twist here. Mm-hmm. Well, he's not personally present. But he is the Creator Sons are the personal expression of Himself.
Yeah, and you know that's getting into the next section. You know that's talked about. Yeah, you know, so we won't do. Yeah.
Okay. The highly personalized sons of God are clearly discernible by the lower orders of created intelligences, and so do they compensate for the invisibility of the infinite and therefore less discernible Father. The Paradise Creator Sons of the Universal Father are a revelation of an otherwise invisible being, invisible because of the absoluteness and infinity inherent in the circle of eternity and in the personalities of the Paradise deities.
Oh, wait, is there a question before we go on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So what would be an example of a not-so-highly personalized Son of God? I mean, what does highly personalized mean?
Meaning brought down to a focus point at your level, at our level, you know, down in the local universe. I mean, you know, how long is it before you'll, you know, be able to recognize, I mean, you know, let's not so much think of sons, but just, you know, in general, you know, the higher personalities of God. I mean, some of those, you know, you can't even begin to, you know, recognize yet.
But on a different level, they're still highly personalized. Like, that seems like an odd way to say.
It's in the context of, okay, see, notice, invisible because of the absoluteness and infinity inherent in the circle of eternity. Okay, so that's one thing. But then they say, and in the personalities of the Paradise deities. Okay, so right there, they're saying that the kind of personality that the Paradise deities have is not what they're calling highly personalized in the case of a Creator Son. That's they're making the contrast between the two.
So does it mean like highly individualized?
Again, it's you have these three infinite personalities, and it's like, well, okay, in what way am I using the word personality there? Well, I must be using it in a pretty high way, because I also know there's this stuff about absoluteness and infinity, and just think about what you know about a Creator Son. So this is he's a Creator personality, but he can actually be expressed as a creature, literally. Okay, so you know, you can bring that personality, even though it's Creator personality, you can bring it down to a focus that's directly relatable, you know, for creatures. Remember, that's the one fundamental difference you know between personality. You have Creator personality and creature personality. So, that's the sense that they mean. I mean, personalized. Like, for instance, I mean, I'm trying to remind yourself of the spectrum in which they use personality. They'll talk about the finite God as being a personality, but when you go to God the ultimate, that's a super personality. Okay, so you know, see, and another way of saying that is, from our perspective, a super personality is not highly personalized. That is just not focused for us. So how much more is it going to be when you go beyond super personality, you know, all the way up to omnipersonality? Okay, that's just, I mean, in an abstract sense, okay, yeah, it's personal, but not, you know, relative to you and I. You have to recognize that they're invoking the, fundamentally, they're going to use the word personality tied to the finite, you know, the supreme. That's where specifically the word personality implies. If, you know, when you're in a technical mode, here they're in a technical mode because they're contrasting it to the infinite, you know, so-called personalities, okay? So that's what they mean by it. All right. Let's hear this. We want to get a little discussion in on this third paragraph. It's not a throwaway paragraph. So.
Okay. Creatorship is hardly an attribute of God. It is rather the aggregate of his acting nature. And this universal function of creatorship is eternally manifested as it is conditioned and controlled by all the coordinated attributes of the infinite and divine reality of the first source and center. We sincerely doubt whether any one characteristic of the divine nature can be regarded as being antecedent to the others. But if such were the case, then the creatorship nature of deity would take precedence over all other natures, activities, and attributes. And the creatorship of deity culminates in the universal truth of the fatherhood of God.
Okay. Now, they're invoking the infinite eternal elixir. Okay, so let's just see that as the last thing we do here for the evening. Notice the sequence you had, nature's activities and attributes. You know, and we talked about natures, and, you know, right at the beginning of the paragraph, they threw in this, it's like, you wouldn't really call creatorship an attribute. It is rather the aggregate of the acting nature. So they stuck that activities, is distinct from nature and, you know, and attributes. See, and they got them in a sequence. Nature, activities, attributes. Okay? And they've got the first source and center in here, you know, and they're reminding us of the universal Father, you know, the Father of God. And of course, they're talking about creatorship, the universal creator. You know, we know what that facet of God the Father is called, but it's involved in creatorship. Okay, so just see that in the chart, what they're invoking. They're saying we're going to go on, you know, we said we're going to go on a journey out into what the consequences are here of the nature, out into the attributes. Well, if we start at the root of the Father and head out towards the lastly, you know, infinite upholder, you know, we're going around this way. So what do we have? We have the first source and center, you know, then the universal Father, then the universal Creator. See, they're in that order. Okay? And the universal Creator is then pointing us out to where we are. You know, and that next thing about the universal controller. But let's just see what they're saying here. So, you know, those whole things about the nature, like I said, you get that by insight. Remember how we were saying, you know, if you're here in the finite sector, you know, where you're being gauged by the sevenfold, you know, the evolutional, you know, this is the evolutionality of deity, the evolutional level here, you know. From that finite viewpoint, you look towards infinity. You know, they invoked, the infinity of God. You know, you look in this direction. Okay, here's the horizon line of your conceptual sight. Okay? It takes insight to see beyond that horizon line. You can't see it with direct sight, conceptual sight. It takes insight to see the first source and center, the nature, that foundational nature of God in the first source and center. You know, God as the first source and center. The nature of God. Okay? Okay, and they say as we come out and we start thinking about the creatorship, notice how it says that, and the creatorship of deity culminates in the universal truth of the fatherhood of God. I mean, if you're looking at what you kind of see directly with your conceptual sight and you're thinking about that creatorship, that the concept of the creatorship of God as a universal creator, that as you penetrate through that, it culminates in the universal Father facet. Okay, that's what that viewpoint is culminating in. Okay, so all of it is kind of just very directly there. And now think about, they say, you know, and they're kind of pointing out that you've got nature moving into activities, and these attributes are probably what lies out here past the universal creator as we go in search of these attributes of God. So with that picture in mind, it says, we sincerely doubt whether any one characteristic of the divine nature can be regarded as being antecedent to the others. But if such were the case, then the creatorship nature of deity would take precedence over all other. Okay? Well, it's in this sense of, see, the Father is coming from the root of the first center, projecting out. And so as we begin, you know, as we really think about, you know, this whole nature activity, source of attribute phenomenon, this, you know, the spear point here that they've built up, you know, takes us to the creator. You know, it's from the creator that it's going to go out. And let me just tease a little bit for next time. You know, we're very much going to notice that this is going to come up. If you glance over, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the seventh paragraph in the first section, it starts with the words, the universal controller. It's the first time they've actually used that direct expression. See, what's next? Okay. This creatorship, they have this little paragraph in here as a transition. You know, we've been built, you know, we've got the nature, and we're wanting to get out here into how it engages us. And that creator, if you remember when we studied total deity, the facet of the Father that's called the universal creator is the relationship between element one and element two, between that which acts and that which reacts. I mean, in order therefore to be any results like you and me, I actually got it that time, any results or universes or anything, the first thing, you know, hence, you know, the creatorship nature would take precedence over all others. I mean, obviously there has to be the whole bringing things into existence. You know, that's the biggie. They're trying to just get you to think about that logically. That which acts has to act on that which reacts before we've got anything. See, so that's the spear point, and that's what they're bringing in. So so now we've got the first source and center, the universal Father, the universal Creator. He's created. Now what? And that's the story of this paper. Now what? And it's not surprising that you have the first appearance of the name of the next facet of the Father, the universal controller. And so when we get to that section or that paragraph, you'll see how they're invoking the precision of what that facet of the Father is, very precisely. Mm-hmm. Now, that's art. That's beautiful. That it's all, I mean, you know, once you see that picture, they're following it. It's just very obvious.
The technique of the Creator.
They're showing you the truth of the Father. You start at the root and you fall out. Remember, they even did it back when we were talking about how, you know, we noticed how they were going through the facets in order, you know, and they took us out to the infinite boulder. You know, they did them in order. They're following the truth of the Father. The truth of the Father goes that way around the infinite eternal ellipse. So everything is constructed that way, very definitively. It's very artistic and way cool.
True art.
Yeah. All right. So we'll engage God's everywhereness next time. Let's take a moment here.